I worked over 560 death investigations in my 10 years, and if you do the math, which I'm bad at, but that's about one a week. When EMS got there and I stood up and backed away, I felt this wall go up. It was my emotional wall, and I had that wall for the rest of my career. So I came up with this idea, maybe I could start telling stories of real people, people who've done the job. And in the books, I asked them all to talk about what they consider to be a career-defining moment. I'm in such a good place, but I recognize how a lot of people aren't and what it takes to get there. That's another reason that I'm just really passionate about first responder wellness.
Welcome to Respond Resilience, along with my co-host Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be joined by Donna Brown, a retired police sergeant and award-winning author of the Behind and Beyond the Badge series, speaking about why Donna wrote her book series, First Responder Wellness and Mental Health and Life After a First Responder Career. And coming up right after Donna Brown's interview, we'll be featuring a new segment called Resilience Toolbox. We'll be speaking with Captain Robert Webb about his workers' comp cancer navigator packets. If you're a firefighter or know one who's been diagnosed with cancer, these packets are vital for navigating and filing workers' comp claims for occupational exposure. So stay tuned right after Donna's interview for Resilience Toolbox. We invite you to like and subscribe. YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness Inc. and Respond to Resilience. PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is ResponderTV.com. We'll be right back to speak with Donna after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB. Today, we're joined by Donna Brown. She's one of only five female officers hired in 1979 by the Tallahassee Police Department. And Donna was a patrol officer, FTO, training officer, FTO sergeant, detective sergeant for 15 years, and 10 of those were supervising the department's homicide unit. Donna retired in 2006 after a 26-year career and became an author. Volume one of Donna's award-winning Behind and Beyond the Badge series was published in 2017. Volume 2 published in 2018, and Volume 3 in 2022. Donna's passionate about humanizing the badge and first responder mental health. Donna, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you very much. It's an honor. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you, and we know we're on the same page with our mission, which is also great. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, we are.
So I want to go back in time a little bit, back to 1979. Was your department and the community accepting of having female officers at that time?
No. Very, very short answer. No. Yeah. And actually, the reason I had the opportunity to even apply is a young lady before me had to sue the city of Tallahassee. Is the police department just did not hire women. Mm-hmm. And so she won. And there were three other women that were hired, but I believe it was 10 months before me. And then myself and another were hired together, making five total. I had a great group of guys. It was challenging when I first started. Initially, the supervisors were just in the FTO program trying to do everything to get me to quit. And then the community was a whole different avenue. They just didn't think we were real police officers. But I think all of it made me a better police officer in the long run.
And so you had a number of assignments. And during those assignments, like, how did you enjoy them, or how did they suit you and your skill set? And then what was it like supervising so many type A personalities?
For sure. I looking back, I would have to say I always loved the training aspect, both as an FTO, as an FTO sergeant, and working in the training unit itself. So providing training for sworn and civilian employees. And at that time, we had our own dispatch center. So they were included in a lot of the training. And then when I got into the Criminal Investigation Bureau, we started our police academy, Citizens Police Academy. And I started teaching that very first class and taught every one of them till the end. So the humanizing it and you know, trying to get recruits and getting them to understand that, even way back when it really wasn't a thing. It just kind of grew, but that was really my favorite. I absolutely loved my 10 years in homicide though. I would have to say that is by far my favorite position.
To stick with the female theme a little bit, Donna, do you feel like there's more representation now with females, and how much do you think that's changed, and where do you still think we need to maybe go in the future?
It absolutely has changed. My old department, I believe, is running about 15% female, which is a huge plus. We've had women as deputy chiefs now, all the way through the rank structure. So there has been great improvement. I know there's a big push nationally. I believe it's called the 30 by 30 initiative to have 30% of law enforcement agencies female. I think that's a lofty goal, but I think it's doable. And I know there's a lot of agencies who are really behind that and working on that. I think it's every department, whether it's a fire department or a police department, it needs to be representative of the community they serve. So I'm very supportive of that for that reason alone.
Sounds like you had an amazing career. Mm-hmm. And that, like all good things, must come to an end. What was your transition like into life after law enforcement, and how did you move into the world of writing books?
Everyone kept telling me to be prepared. And again, you're looking, and I know a whole different generation. So I retired in 2006. So I've been retired a while. So there wasn't a lot of help or, you know, what can I do? What should I do? So I relied on some of the guys that had retired before me. And my biggest question was, how do you know when it's time to go? And I'm looking for this great wisdom. And honestly, to a person, the answer I got is, you'll know. I'm like, okay. And honestly, I woke up one morning to go to work, and I'm sitting on the side of the bed, and I went, I'm done. I mean, it was truly for me just that simple. So it was a matter of picking a date, but I had been approached to get into a company. And so when I retired, I transitioned right into that and spent about 8 years doing that, and then realized, and it was kind of law enforcement related, but after that I was like, I'm done dealing and living in the dark world. And I just did not want to do that anymore. I really didn't want to do anything law enforcement related, and really just kind of took a year off after that and did nothing.
You know, I wanted to ask you, the dark world. I mean, David and I chuckled because we know what you mean. But could you elaborate on that and how that impacts a law enforcement officer over time and decades of a career of seeing that underbelly?
Sure. Part of my new career or the company that I went into was helping law firms. And my primary goal was, like, I worked a lot with the city of Tallahassee's attorneys, and it was helping them when the city was sued for wrongful death. And most of it being law enforcement, officer involved shootings, those type of situation. So I just continued to be in that world, and it's a heavy world. And 10 years in homicide, I didn't realize how much stress I was under until I got out. And of course, staying in the city that I worked in, I couldn't drive around town without going, oh, I worked that there, or I worked that there, a suicide there, a homicide there. And that was tough. I didn't realize it all until I was retired. And again, back then, there was no wellness. That just wasn't a thing back then. And that's why I think I'm so passionate about seeing it evolve and get better for all first responders. I worked over 560 death investigations in my 10 years. And if you do the math, which I'm bad at, but that's about one a week for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't count the time I spent on patrol. It's just, there was nothing positive pretty much in that world that I lived in. Those 10 years specifically in homicide.
Wow.
Come on. Check it.
What were the steps, or how did you get to the point where you got the idea, or somebody encouraged you to write a book? How did that evolve?
It was in 2016. I believe that was around the time of Michael Brown and the Ferguson explosion. And, law enforcement was just demonized horribly then. And I got angry, and I was like, what can I do to change that narrative? And, we all know there's people in any profession that don't need to be there. And that certainly has come out with the law enforcement profession. And that's when I came up with, people need to know that there's a person behind the badge. I don't care what badge, if it's a firefighter, if it's a dispatcher, people fascinate me. I love, everyone has a story, and I get accused of asking people too many questions because I'm fascinated.
Me too, Donna.
Yes. Yes. So I came up with this idea. Maybe I could start telling stories of real people who've done the job. And so with the first book, everybody's retired, because I really didn't know how agencies were going to accept this or whatever. And almost to a T, every person I reached out to, now in volume one, every person I personally knew and had worked with, and they jumped at my idea. And I started going with that. But then I realized, I said, I have to include at least one firefighter, at least one dispatcher. For me, I had to include someone from forensics. And it ended up becoming what I call my village of first responders. I could not have done my job without each and every one of those people. And I could tell stories about how and why for each one of those categories. And so I went with it. And I started out sending everybody like a questionnaire. And I've done the same with volume two and volume three. And it forced them to write. Because I told him, I said, I don't want superficial. I really would like you to open up your hearts. And almost to a T, when I got things back, was how kind of healing it was, how it just kind of, and they, didn't realize what kind of baggage they were still holding on to. So it really, I was really proud of how volume one turned out, and then subsequently the other two. But so that's how it happened.
Well, I was going to ask you, when you asked people and you said they jumped at the opportunity, why do you think they jumped at it and wanted to tell their story?
I believe strongly it was the climate of the country towards the law enforcement profession. And that's such a small percentage of you know, out of 800,000 law enforcement officers, that's just such a small percentage. And, you know, it was, when I talked to them, I'm like, you know, it's who you are, you know, and if in volume one, you know, I've got a cancer survivor, I've got, and I actually included a woman whose husband had been killed in the line of duty. I thought that perspective was important. And so everybody was like, yes, people need to know we're real people, just like everybody else. We just happen to put on different clothes to go to work every day.
Right.
So, I mean, I did get some skepticism with a few people, but for the most part, almost everybody jumped right at it. Yes, let me participate.
And I love the fact that you're including not only all the different related professions, but the families, because they are, you know, by proxy first responders, right? They're
correct.
They're kind of living through our, by you know, vicariously, if you will, or you know, as a ride along
right.
in our career. And it's so important to hear that perspective. And they go through things that we can't even imagine, right? That we're not
right.
there to witness. So, have you had any family members who have brought forward a perspective that you thought was interesting?
Yes. And more so after the first and second volumes came out. Matter of fact, I had a gentleman, he's a retired sergeant. He and his wife read volume two together. Hmm. And when they were finished, and he told me, he says, you know, we have a great communicative relationship. We've always been able to talk about everything. But he told me when they finished reading volume two, she said, do you think and feel that way like all these people do? And he's like, I do. And he said it just really opened up a whole nother avenue of communication. And he began to share stuff that he never talked to her about. And honestly, if I never sell another copy of a book, that in itself made it worthwhile. So in volume two, I tell a mother's perspective. Her son was killed in the line of duty. He actually happened to be one of my coworkers. And I thought it was imperative. Again, that's just a different perspective. You know, that you see a death, any first responder death on the news, you may see something on the funeral, yeah. and then it's gone. And life goes on, which it does, but not for these people. I mean, life does go on, but there's just so much more, as you guys know.
Mm-hmm. So that one story of the husband and wife is really nice to hear, that they could also open up their line of communication on a different level. Are there any other stories that you feel capture this positive light and this light of change?
Yes, and part of the theme, and it was more prevalent, I think, in volume one, the old adage of things are not always as they appear. And, you know, we got into, and when I do some of the public speaking, I'm like, you know, when you see a video from the news, it's 10 seconds and it's what they want you to see. It doesn't show the whole thing. And in volume one, one of the officers, he talks about a situation like that, that really changed his life. And in the books, I asked them all to talk about what they consider to be a career defining moment. Mm-hmm. Some have more than one. I did. And in this particular case, this officer just happens to roll up on a physical altercation, and he sees what he believes is an adult on top of a juvenile trying to stab him. And he gets out. And of course, when he yells at him, the guy's not stopping. He had every right to shoot. And he said, for some reason, something in his head just said, don't. And he went up to the guy, and this was a big officer, and he kind of kicked him in the butt to get him off the other guy. Ended at positive ending, but what he thought was an adult trying to stab a juvenile was just the opposite. It was a 16-year-old kid who was just a big kid trying to stab a 40-year-old man.
Wow.
And, you know, he thought just, you know, that just taking that extra second, now granted an extra second can be deadly too, but for him it changed his perspective of doing the job. So I really liked when I really asked everybody to dig deep, what do you consider a career defining moment? It was really, I was overwhelmed sometimes at the responses I got and just how open everybody was. I was proud, very proud.
You get a sense of if the public is reading this and it's changing their perception? Like, are you getting feedback from, you know, people outside the profession that's positive?
I have. I wish I could get it out there even more, because I think those people need to read it more than those who are within the profession. Although I've had some, you know, that sergeant is one, but I had a deputy reach out to me and just said, I loved reading your stories because it helped me realize I'm not alone in my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it certainly has its place within the professions. But yeah, my goal is to really have people outside the profession to read it more. And that's really what I've been trying to focus on. And it's again, cyclical with the climate of the country towards the profession. So it's kind of difficult.
You've mentioned career defining moments a couple of times, right. But can you talk about what that means in general, but talk about what it means to you?
Sure. Well, like the scenario I just explained with the officer, it just, you know, it was a shock to him. I tell two for me. One, I'd only been working about a year, and I was working midnights, and I got dispatched to a hit and run, vehicle versus pedestrian. And when I got there, the pedestrian is laying in the street next to the curb, and it's obvious to me he has brain mass coming out of his ears. So I know this is a fatality. It just, he was still alive though. So there's a few people standing on the sidewalk, and it grew a little bit, and everybody starts yelling at me, do something for him, do something for him. You know, I had EMS on the way. I went to my car. I got a blanket out of the trunk. I went over to him. I knelt down with him. I covered him up. I'm talking to him. People are yelling and screaming at me. Why aren't you doing anything? And, you know, I held his hand and just, I watched him die. That was my first death. That was... And when EMS got there and I stood up and backed away, it was weird. I felt this wall go up. It was my emotional wall. And I had that wall for the rest of my career. Mm. It served its purpose, certainly, especially my 10 years in homicide. You kind of have to have that. Mm-hmm. So it served its purpose, but at the same time, it was a huge hurdle for me to try to get over once I retired. So that's one. The other was it's kind of a longer story, but I was faced, and every officer has the story of, I almost shot A, and mine was, and this person made the right choice, and I had every right to shoot him. And when I didn't have to, he ended up dropping the gun. It was a realization to me, or a reminder, or whatever, what power I have as a police officer, you know, that, and had he made a different decision, both of our lives would have been changed forever. Mm-hmm. And so it just, it was career defining for me. And I said, I've had a couple throughout my 26 years, but those are the two big ones.
And I'm sure David and I have ours too, that, you know, they stick with you. And I would imagine when you're that young officer and you're standing there, I remember being a young EMT standing there. If you don't put that wall up,
right,
you realize the next time this one happens, how am I going to do my job with all these people yelling or all right. the chaos that ensues around you, right? But so the wall's necessary,
yes.
but it's like you really grasped what that meant to you to get through a career, because you have to have something like a barrier. But I like your point of one day you need to really think about that and allow yourself to process it.
And it did. Well, I mean, that was probably the first couple of years when I retired.
Right.
And again, coming from a whole different generation about wellness and that, I was diagnosed with PTSD, cumulative, obviously.
Yeah.
But I'm in such a good place. But I recognize how a lot of people aren't and what it takes to get there. So again, that's another reason that I'm just really passionate about first responder wellness.
We're in the middle of a retirement episode right now that we're building. Actually, it'll be two parts. And this is one of the things that we focus on, is that when people retire, they're not prepared for the flood of emotions or the parade right. of faces to come back. So what you're describing just further validates the need for us to talk about that, for people to feel prepared, and then to know that help is available when that day comes.
Yes. And I am seeing more, you probably could speak to this more than I can, but just from where I sit, I'm seeing more of a push for the culturally competent right. mental health professionals.
Yes.
And in my latest book in volume 3, so many of them are phenomenal stories, but Dan is an incredible story. Real quick, Dan was shot in the line of duty. He was a SWAT officer, and he's now paralyzed from the waist down in a wheelchair, but his department, so supportive, kept him on. He's a sworn officer still. He's the department's wellness coordinator.
Wow.
And he's also a retired military vet. And he definitely talks about what a dark place he went into. He had suicidal ideations. And then how his light bulb came on and the transformation for him. And he should be, and his wife, who's a police sergeant, they both should be completing their MSWs at Colorado State this year, I believe. And that is they want to work with for all first responders and vets. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of good work being done out there.
Yes.
And hear about more and more every day. And it's exciting. Yesterday, just put together a compilation of different mental health resources for law enforcement officers for an organization that was asking for it. And the more research I did, the more I realized we're blessed at this moment to have so many different organizations and great
right.
people out there who are just coming from the heart, wanting to be of service and to support brothers and sisters who are out there doing the job. So when someone retires, what do you see as ways they can transfer their skills that they've acquired during their career into something positive in retirement?
There certainly is a place for that outside of the actual profession, but I'm going to go a different direction if you don't mind.
Sure.
Everybody has a talent. And there's a gentleman in volume 3, the recent one, Jim, his college degree is in the fine arts. He was an artist, but he realized he wasn't going to make a living doing that at the time. His brother-in-law was in law enforcement, and Jim ended up going to law enforcement. He retired as the deputy chief at Florida State University Police Department. He's gone back to his first love. He's opened up a studio here in town. He's all over social media. He's back to doing his passion. I mean, he was an incredible law enforcement officer, but there's so many officers who have woodworking skills, who have amazing writing skills, those kinds of things. And I encourage people, you know, think what are you passionate about? You know, and I think the biggest is people are afraid what's going to happen when I do transition. And that's why preparing before you do that is a huge must. But I encourage people, what are you passionate about? Gardening, but, you know, painting, what is it? And almost everybody can come up with something. I have a gentleman now, his side business is he hand makes horse saddles, the leather work, and they're gorgeous. You know, so I actually kind of encourage people to get away from the professions if they can.
Interesting.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
Well, we're encouraged that, to touch to your point before, we're so encouraged by the amount of first responders who are getting a degree in counseling or social work. It's incredible. It's great. And it means more of us on the ground helping people, because there aren't enough of us.
I agree.
And Stacy and I, you know, we talk about this a lot, the need for more and more of us. So the fact that people are actually doing that as a second career is a no-brainer. They can take all of that knowledge and help the next generation so that they don't become them.
Right.
You know, and it's incredible. We time and time again, I feel every week, David, we hear more people telling us they're going to get the degree. So the more the merrier. Please keep them coming.
Well, and I think too, there's a gentleman, he's in volume 3, who's gotten very big with their department, has finally got up and running a great peer-to-peer support system. They hired a wellness coordinator a couple of years ago. It's gotten so wonderful, they had to hire an assistant for her. And he's now talking about, he thinks he wants to start working on his master's for that very thing. So I agree with you. I encourage all of those. And I think, yeah, you are taking some of the skills you've learned. You have to have the ability to talk to people, and you have to be a good listener to be good at any of these jobs. That's my personal opinion. And I think that certainly can be transitioned into what you do, Bonnie, for sure.
Well, and unfortunately, first responders usually wait until they're really, really struggling, until they call us.
Right.
And so imagine if they end up picking a name out of the phone book or on Google, and they don't know the person, and they go and it doesn't turn out well, they're not likely to ever go back.
Correct.
And we know that. So when we get calls from first responders, we know it's their 911. And it's imperative for them to go to a therapist who understands the culture. Because if a first responder feels they have to protect the therapist from their pain or the stories, that it's not going to work.
Right.
We have to be able to handle the material they have to give us.
Right.
There's something very interesting, too, that happens in our office a lot. The first responders, just like they protect everyone in their family and in the community, they want to protect us, too. And I have some that come in where we have a little power struggle of like, in my office, I'm in charge of protecting you. It's not your job to protect me.
Right.
You know, so it's very interesting how ingrained the patterns really are that we talk about. But
And matter of fact, I in volume 1, because I include victim advocates. Our department had, I actually supervised our victim advocate unit for many years. At the time I was doing homicide, and I made them an integral part of the investigative team. She worked on her master's, and once she left the police department, she went into private practice, and she's doing a lot of EAP work now. No, she wasn't a cop, but she knows. I mean, she, because our victim advocates were on call just like our detectives. Mm-hmm. So if I'm out at a homicide scene and I have family, they were called out. So they're there in the blood and the gore. Mm-hmm. So they have that perspective. They understand what you're seeing, what you're talking about. And that's that gets in when I talk about crime scenes. That's why I included forensics people. They're always left out.
That's right.
And that bugs the bejesus out of me. And I'm like, you know, and I get this from within the profession. They're not first responders. No, they're not. But let's just, on a grandiose scale, let's take the Pulse nightclub. Okay. Mm-hmm. A scene like that takes days to process. Okay.
Yeah.
They're seeing it. They're measuring it. They're photographing it. They're collecting it. They're stepping over it. Yeah. They're processing it. They're having to testify to it later. They're writing reports about it. How can you not include them? How can you not include them? Yeah. And well, they're not first responders. I'm like, get rid of that, you know, label. Mm-hmm.
We call them the last responders.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So, you know, and then, you know, one thing too, like with the, I talked to a person who was at the Pulse and they're like, the one thing that really, all the cell phones that were ringing. And you know, their loved ones trying to, you know, check, are you okay? Are you, you know, and that just, you know, was something that just, it hit them, you know, this person can't answer the phone, you know? So if you guys are working, you know, or including, forensics people, thank you very much for doing that.
Yeah. We have had one episode with an amazing forensics person, who also is paying it forward in terms of mental health and doing some of her own podcast and her own work to support, you know, what is really a niche in a way and much misunderstood, but she does great work. And we have also featured animal control, which is another piece that gets overlooked a lot.
Sure, sure. And I apologize. I will go back and find the episodes and listen.
Well,
that's wonderful.
Now, we had Catherine Pope, and she really taught us a lot about this. Things that, like you said, people don't really think about what they have to be exposed to.
Right.
And she coined that term last responder, which really stuck with David.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that. I may have to use that then. You know, and it goes into, like, you know, people talk about firefighters, you know, and I utilized fire in homicide for so many things that they wouldn't, now I look back on, I exposed them to things that they wouldn't maybe normally have seen. Mm-hmm. I had a person who got up on a billboard at a very busy intersection and hung themselves. So the morning commute, you know, but we couldn't get up there. So I had to call the fire department with a bucket truck and they took my detectives up there to get, you know, so I mean, I'm exposing. So they do see other things than just going and putting out a fire, you know, that kind of stuff. So they're just, that's my village. I'm passionate about all of them.
Well, Donna, anything we didn't cover you'd like to speak to as far as your books or anything you're up to?
No, I mean, the only thing with the books, you don't have to have read them in order by any means. I would encourage, you know, police explorers to read, officers, spouses, anybody on the outside of any of these professions that you can get to read the books. There's a lot of different groups that I think can benefit from reading even just one of the books or even a couple of the stories. So they're all available on Amazon or there's links through my website and stuff. So I appreciate you having me on.
Sure. And Donna, what's your website address so people can find you?
It's behindandbeyondthebadge.com. Hmm. And I am on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook. I'm not a huge fan of social media, but it has its place. And certainly, you know, for trying to reach people with the books and stuff. So I'm a little bit of everywhere.
Great. And what's next? What do you have waiting in the wings as your next endeavor?
I don't know. To be honest with you, after I wrote volume one, I had no intention of writing volume two. And people were like, no, we want more stories. And then I wrote volume three. But I think I'm just going to take a break. I want to help. And I'm trying to figure out another way that I can help, you know, whether it's, you know, promoting people like you and your organizations and what you're doing. You know, I love speaking to professional groups and just the public and anything I can do to humanize. That's really my lot in life for me.
Well, I think you've succeeded today, and it's been really wonderful to meet you and talk to you. And we thank you so much for your time.
I again, thank you so much for having me. I love meeting you both, and I hope we can stay in touch. And I said, whatever I can do to help you guys, please let me know.
Thank you, Donna. Awesome work. And it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Take care.
Welcome to this edition of Resilience Toolbox. On this edition, we'll be speaking with Captain Robert Webb. He's a retired captain from the Fort Worth, Texas Fire Department, where he was a truck captain for 22 years and a total of 33 years of service, ending his career as a technical rescue coordinator. Today, we're going to be speaking about your cancer packets. This is a tool that I think many people need to know about. I can speak from personal experience that if I had known about it when I had file a workers' comp claim for cancer, it probably would have totally changed the game for me. So let's dive in and find out more about this. Captain Webb, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to create the Webb Cancer Navigator packets.
I was extremely healthy all my life. I was lucky that I didn't have to work out much, but I did work out every day just because of the nature of my job. I was a firefighter that really didn't have any known problems with cancer in my family. I really never paid attention to that there was a presumptive law for cancer in the state. And at the time, I looked at the requirements for the conditions to meet the presumption, and I had all those boxes checked. So I really felt at the time that I would be immediately accepted. Workers' comp carriers have 60 days to deny your claim. And on the 57th day, they denied my claim. And this time I had been through two rounds of heavy chemo, R-CHOP chemo. Then I had to start really trying to figure out what I needed for my presumption to succeed, for me to win my case. There's only one paragraph that states what the requirements were at the time. And it was you had to find the known products of combustion that caused your cancer. And they had to be found within the books of the IARC monographs. But it did list all the products of combustion that were in smoke and fires and in overhaul and in diesel exhaust. I had to formulate that information and make it usable where I could present it and win my case. From there, I went and built more packets as they were requested.
So these cancer packets cover a multitude of different kinds of cancers, correct?
Yes, there's 24 types of cancer that there's packets for now. And there's a name for each one of those packets. It's because someone called me, or I personally knew someone that had that cancer and needed that packet. It can't be stressed enough that the timeline that you need this packet quickly. You have a limited amount of time from the time you get diagnosed to the time you file your case. Usually that's 30 days from the time you are diagnosed and the time you exhaust that time to file. It's not very long. It's 30 days. So, and in that period of time after that, you're going to be asked for information. It happens pretty quickly. And someone going through cancer treatment necessarily isn't trying to think about all those things. So it's really helpful to get that information as quick as you can.
What's the single most important thing to remember if you're diagnosed with a presumptive cancer?
Well, the single most important thing is the timely reporting. When you're told by a doctor that you have cancer, you have 30 days, at least in the state of Texas, and most states have timelines. Workers' comp laws that cover all workers stipulates all the timelines. So you still fall in line with those same timelines. So 30 days to report from the time you're told you have cancer is a pretty hard and fast rule. You know, you have to be on your toes, either the people that work with you, your supervisors, or someone that knows you're diagnosed really needs to be on their toes and fill that paperwork out and get it reported. Regardless if you want to file workers' comp or not, at least report it and to where you're not excluded right from the get-go.
Who do I share my packet with once I receive one?
Well, once you receive one, usually the kind of the order of things that will happen is you'll report your injury, your illness within 30 days, and then you'll get this packet, and then you'll be assigned a adjuster through your workers' comp carrier. It'll be a claims adjuster. And so the first person you'll share that with is them. There's a piece of paper in there called a doctor's guide, and that's really meant to go to your physician. But basically, the doctor's guide lists the products of combustion that caused your cancer, where they're located within that packet, and how you possibly were exposed to those, whether they're through smoke and fires, through overhaul, or through diesel exhaust. So whether you have to get an attorney, whether your association is representing your fire association, or whether you're representing yourself, then that's where that packet really becomes important. You need to make sure that you have that packet. And if you don't understand the packet, definitely ask me, call me, or have your attorney or whoever call me. I've talked to a lot of them also, trying to explain to them what's important. And there's a packet called IARC in there that's out of the International Institute of Research of Cancer Monographs. And those are the most important documents, because those are scientific documents coming from doctors that state that this product of combustion caused this cancer.
Captain Webb, is there a charge for the packets?
No, I've done all this for free. I would have given anything when I went through mine the first time to have had something I could have just downloaded and say, here it is. This is the information I need. But when you're going through treatment and you're going through chemo and you're not feeling well, and that's really why I do it, because I know I've been through that myself. To understand that these packets don't guarantee that you're going to win the case. It just gives you the information to allow you to hopefully win your case. But there's a lot of pitfalls within the workers' comp process that you need to be made aware of. And if people call, when they call me, I tell them those things. I ask them questions and tell them those things. That way I don't try to give them false hope. The system is really designed for you to lose. And this hopefully swings the pendulum to your favor, having these packets. Now, if you're in a state that you have a cancer that isn't on the list, I would still encourage you to file. In Texas, we've had several firefighters win using my packets and showing the information there with cancers that aren't listed, and still they came out on top and won. But
where can people find you out there on the internet or directly?
If anybody would like to get a hold of me, my email is rweb774@me.com. And my phone number, they're welcome to text me or call me. It's 817-999-0573. That's my personal cell phone. So if they would like information, you're not bothering me if you call.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this and for doing this amazing tool for firefighters who are probably going through one of the worst, if not the worst, chapters of their life. It cannot be understated how critically important this is for all the ramifications of filing a workers' comp claim. It's a huge contribution, and I salute you for that.
Yes, sir. You're welcome.
Don't forget, like and subscribe on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder Resilience, PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms. Our website is ResponderTV.com with all the past episodes. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.